Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. Get ready. Saturday, August 6th is Mead Day. In celebration of this sweet homebrew holiday, the American Homebrewers Association is offering listeners $5 off membership with promo code MEADDAY22. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to download a variety of mead recipes, find a homebrew supply shop, and dust off your mead-making skills with how-to videos. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to get $5 off for Mead Day when you join or renew by August 8th, 2022. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 14th, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, it's back to Pittsburgh and HomebrewCon. Steve Wilkes, Zod O'Connor, and I spent some time talking to Dr. Matt Winans from Imperial Organic Yeast about homebrew sake and hybridizing yeast. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already seen a pre-release of the video episode that I'm posting to the public on Friday, along with an exclusive behind-the-scenes video and recipe for the beer. It's my no-boil Zamba Capri Nipa. I talk about it a bit in this week's interview. In addition to the process that I tell Dr. Matt in the interview, I dry hopped my beer in the keg after coming back from HomebrewCon. I had a bunch of leftover hops in the freezer from past samplers. 5 different varieties went into the beer into the keg, and I gave each of those varieties a peek and a sniff before I put them in there, and they still smelled and looked good to me, and I'm glad that I added them because they gave a brightness that was a little lacking in the original beer. More details coming up in the video episode. I'm excited about the new hybrids that our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast are working on. In addition to the projects that Dr. Matt is going to refer to, Eben at Imperial teased that Imperial is starting to play with bioprospecting. So, harvesting and taming wild yeasts. No more details on that yet, and it may be in the early stages, but I'm really looking forward to hearing more about that. It proves and goes to back up that Imperial is already knocking it out of the park when it comes to a wide range of dependable yeast strains. If you've used Imperial, you know. And say it with me. I like to say that my stir plate is dusty, because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. And if I pitch in the early afternoon, my airlock is usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew store about Imperial Organic Yeast and check out their range of yeast strains at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Shout out to Brad Smith of Beersmith Brewing Software and the Beersmith Podcast. Brad had me as a guest on his show. That episode may be out by the time that you hear this. Brad and I had a fun chat, and a lot of it was about the early days and evolution of beer podcasting. We also talked a bit about small batches and no or short boil brews. And if you can stand it, there's also a video version of the Beersmith podcast, so you can, you can check that out on YouTube. It's probably easier just to listen to the show rather than to have to see my face for an hour. But I appreciate Brad's hospitality and having me on the Beersmith podcast. It's weird for me to be on that side of the microphone, especially since, you know, I have no editing control. But luckily, I don't think I made any comments or jokes that'll haunt me later. This is the second show from HomebrewCon in Pittsburgh. And as you know, one of my favorite things about HomebrewCon is being able to talk to the experts and homebrewers who can also be experts, and actually taste the beverages that we're talking about in real time. And I didn't introduce them in the interview, I don't think, but you'll hear Steve Wilkes and Zod O'Connor taking part. I'm always grateful for their company and their input. So let's go back to HomebrewCon in Pittsburgh to the booth on the trade floor of Imperial Organic Yeast. Dr. Matt Winans, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Happy to see you here at HomebrewCon.
Yeah, good to see you in person.
Yeah, 2020, it's a good year, and happy to be here in Pittsburgh.
And we're talking, we got Steve Wilkes.
Hey, James.
And Sean O'Connor.
Howdy.
We're here at the Imperial booth, here on the trade floor. What do they call it? The trade floor?
I don't know. Expo. Who knows? The fun spot.
Yeah. We just heard your presentation on sake, and we're drinking some right now. What have we got?
So right now we have a Jinzhou shu, and it is from Sangokura in Pennsylvania. And it's right outside of Philadelphia, so this is a collaboration that we did with them. And the yeast that they used is going to be our A49, our goodness. And it's a really pleasant to drink sake. It's got a nice balance between the residual sweetness and the acidity. And really it's got a nice finish to it.
Yeah, it's delicious. I told you that I get pear out of it. And you know, it's interesting that just the rice and the yeast and, you know, of course, the koji and all that, I get that fruitiness in there, and there's a bit of tartness as well. It's really a fun thing to drink. What do you think, Steve?
I think all that. But what I was amazed at, which hit me, when you were giving your talk and you talked about the five flavors of sake, your whole talk fell into place for me. So I'm all about flavor and what is it? I'm the end user kind of guy. So everything about how to do it made sense, but when you talked about the flavors of it, then it really made sense, and I got all those flavors in this. So that was really cool. I like that.
So I really get the pear that you're getting, James, but also I really get sake flavor out of this. I mean, I've had sake for a long time on and off and then go years without having it, and you actually kind of get this residual, I'm going to say rice flavor, but it's really almost rice aspect, like the hull and the other things, in a very pleasant, crispy, biscuity kind of way with the pear. And that's really fascinating.
Yeah, biscuity. That's a good characterization of that rice character.
Yeah, I think I get a lot of sake flavor as well. But, you know, if I want to get a little bit more technical about it, I really think that once this warms up, because we're serving it right now on ice, but once this warms up a little bit, you get a lot more esters that really kind of volatilize out of this. And, you know, as we talked about in the presentation, you can have different flavors come out of the five gomi, or the five flavors of sake. You can have different flavors shine through at different temperatures. So with this one, I found that if you heat it up a little bit, it really kind of lets a lot of those esters kind of come out.
Is it a bad thing to heat sake?
No, I mean, as I said in the presentation, it's really a choose your own adventure. The guys and gals down at Sangokura, they say that most of their sake is enjoyed chilled best. But, you know, drinking sake is one of those things that it's pretty fun to do and experiment with. So at home, I usually take it out cold, try it, and then I do a stepwise heating. And yeah, it's kind of every style is a little bit different.
Yeah, years ago, Andy Sparks and I went to Sake One and toured their facility and did a couple of videos with them. And at the ending, we did a tasting. And, you know, I knew nothing about sake. I'd had some homebrew sake that somebody had sent me, and which was delicious. But I didn't know the wide range of different styles, you know, from cloudy, you know, with the sediment, to crystal clear, to flavored, to, you know, so it's a lot more versatile a beverage than people might think.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. And the limited amount of knowledge that I came with given the presentation, it was pretty good. And, you know, personally, when I brew sake, I do the Nigori style, which is cloudy, and I do Nama, which is unpasteurized. But the amount of questions that I got afterwards and talking with people, there's a whole world past what I was even aware of the different styles. So I just love talking with people that are interested in exploring these new styles and techniques. And, yeah, with sake, there's a lot of them that isn't what meets eye at first.
Years and years ago, I interviewed a home brewer, Bob Taylor, I think his name was, from Alaska, who actually sent me some sake, which was delicious. But he described the process of brewing it, and afterwards I was intimidated, you know, because it's a lot different from brewing beer, and it's a lot more labor intensive. You know, you got to take care of it. Like you said, walking the dog, you know, you walk your dog in the morning, you stir the sake, you know, walk your dog in the afternoon, you stir your sake. So what can you tell? We're not going to go through the, if people need to go to, you know, the AHA website and download your presentation or watch your presentation, it's very well done. But what can you tell people, beer brewers, about the sake process to kind of take that intimidation away from the process? Is it as hard as it sounds?
You know, I don't think it's as hard as it sounds. One of the things that I talked about, and yeah, I would suggest people go and hopefully I presented a good presentation.
You did.
Thank you. But, you know, really the main difference is, you know, when you have your beer mash, right, and you're brewing beer, it's the sacrification process. It all builds up to that one moment, right, where you have an hour-long incubation with the barley. And then it's all about getting it up to boil and then cooling it down and pitching the yeast in afterwards. It's very similar, but it's on the cold side. And it's kind of stretched out a little bit further. And so where you're brewing beer, you're kind of doing it all at once, all in one day. And typically when I homebrew, I do that. And then when it comes time to clean up, I don't know, somehow I'm always the one there and all my friends are gone. But with sake, what you do, it just takes a little bit more forethought. And you really just plan it out day-wise. And although it is, laborious isn't the right word, but you do have to do more stuff. But it's less active work, you know, like you're steaming rice. And so if you steam rice, you know, you fill up your rice steamer with water and you fill it up with rice and, you know, you steam it for an hour. So you don't have to stand there and watch it for an hour. You can do other chores. You can do dishes. You can do other stuff around your house. So, yeah, it just takes a little bit more forethought and a little bit more planning and know-how. But, I mean, as far as, like, the ease to do it, I think most homebrewers have everything they need. The only purchase that you'd have to make is a big steamer. And I got mine at an Asian store, Fubon, I think, in Portland, and I think I spent $50 or $75 on it. So it's not that much of a commitment, and you can get a kit from many different places. I got one from F.H. Steinbart, and you know, the recipes there, I have brewing notes on my presentation. So yeah, I don't think it's a high level entry to do this. I just think with a little bit of confidence and some forethought, I think anyone can really do it and enjoy good, and I suggest Nama Nagori style, so unpasteurized table sake.
Is there what was the key to switching gears from the beer brewing mindset to the sake mindset? I mean, is there anything that you in the process was like, oh, okay, I got it now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if there's anything in particular that switched for me. I'm more of like a hands-on person. I really do. I try to read a lot. But for me, even if I do the first batch and it doesn't go exactly as planned, like, it really helps me do number two right. And honestly, if you just follow the brew notes and then any kind of recipe, especially one that you get with like a kit from Steinbart, you know, you're going to be able to do it. Yeah, I didn't say this during the presentation, but yeah, I did mess up one time, like when I first started. So you fill it up with water, right, with your steaming. You just want to make sure you fill it up with enough water. So yeah, just kind of keep a check on it because I definitely burned off all the water one time. And yeah, I mean, if you do that, right, it's not a huge deal. You just kind of get more rice and you steam, and you know, your loss maybe an hour where you weren't really paying attention. Yeah.
So how careful do you have to be about sourcing your ingredients, like the rice and the koji? And, you know, do you recommend some sources over others or some kinds over others? Or, you know, are there, have you had bad experiences with certain kinds of rice? Or, you know, have you heard of people using products that maybe aren't as good as others?
Yeah, your ingredients definitely make a difference. You know, there's three main types of sake rice that are produced, and those are listed in my presentation. There's also three really good water profiles you can copy for sake rice as well. So, yeah, your ingredients definitely matter. And as far as, like, bad experiences go, I don't know if one stands out in particular. I would just say wherever you're getting your rice supply from, make sure you talk with your supplier and let them know what you're doing. I've talked with people who have made sake before, and I've used, you know, Cal Rose table rice, and that's fine. But, you know, when you get into your sake grades, they're really determined by two things, and those are your ingredients. And the two ingredients is the polishing ratio of the rice, so how much of the outside are you removing to get to that starchy endosperm, and then whether or not you're adding the distiller's alcohol to it. And so, yeah, I mean, your sources definitely matter. And when I try to brew anything, you know, time's really expensive, you know, if you value your time at all. So if you're going to do it, I try to do it once right. It's always faster to do it once right than twice not so great.
Yeah, I've made Makali before, and I think I just used, you know, long grain Mahatma rice, and you know, I got some Nuruk from a local Asian grocery store. And, you know, of course, that's a whole different process, and it's a lot more straightforward, a lot less intimidating. So maybe it's a little, you know, maybe you have to be a little bit more picky about the ingredients I get for sake. But you guys have any questions? I mean, what's intimidating to you about the process?
Well, nothing's really intimidating. It's just a different mindset. I was thinking about, I don't speak any Japanese. So I was hearing the words and thinking, I don't understand, you know, they weren't collecting. But then I was thinking, well, you know, when I started brewing, ton didn't make any sense. Louder didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of embracing it and allowing yourself time to learn, I think, mm-hmm. a little bit about how to think about it and talk about it. And like you say, you know, find the rhythm of it, you might say. And then it kind of makes sense. The question that I have is about packaging. So I see here that we've got it in a keg, but then I'm wondering, is it better to package it as wine or as beer? So if you're a hobbyist, you might have the ability to do both of those. Which would you choose?
Yeah, I really think it depends on your style. You can definitely package it as wine. You know, an ordinary sake is usually around 16.5%. So you can use a little bit of water and dilute down to 16.5% and package it that way. Now, if you do that, you probably want to pasteurize. But I've also seen sake on the market that's unpasteurized and bottled. I was in New York the other day, and I saw Brooklyn Cura had unpasteurized sake, and it was bottled. And they actually had it out at room temperature, which at the liquor store I was at, which I was like, oh, man, I don't know if that's the best move. But to answer your question, I really think, for me, I would probably store it more so like a wine. You can definitely package it. And, you know, if you really want to get, you know, take it to the next level, something I've thought about doing, and I've had some great sparkling cider, or not cider, but sparkling sake before. And so you can do that, and you can also put it in a keg and carbonate it that way as well. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to hybridize both the style of winemakers and beer makers with sake. I think it's another tool in our belt. And also, I'd like to say something that Steve brought up, which is probably the biggest change mindset for me, which is just the language and the translation. And that really has a large impact, because I think that's probably the most intimidating is hearing, you know, Jinjo, you know, Jumai and Nama Nagori, and having no idea what that means. You know, I was like, I think those are words. So if you go to the presentation I gave, I actually made a handout, and it talks, I did all the translations. So I have descriptions of what all those things mean, and it really should be a great guidebook for someone starting their adventure in sake brewing.
I need to get ingredients for my next brew. I'm thinking of brewing a variation of the Bell's Two-Hearted Ale clone recipe again, maybe this time with Maris Otter and maybe some Galaxy hops that I got at HomebrewCon. Whatever the recipe winds up to be, you know I'll be brewing it on my Warthog electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave of HighGravityBrew.com. It's good brewing weather out there. It's a great time to be on the patio brewing with my Warthog system. When I was brewing with propane, I liked this time of year because it's hot and not windy. The temperature of my mash in the kettle or the cooler didn't fall as much during the mash rest in the summer, and the wind didn't blow my heat away from my propane burner as much. Well, now, hot or cold, windy or still, my Warthog electric system from HighGravityBrew.com keeps my mash rock solid and my boil rockin'. That's two rock references. It takes the pain out of propane. If you're not rocking a Warthog electric system from HighGravityBrew.com, you should be. Single vessel or two or three vessels, HighGravityBrew.com has a Warthog controller or turnkey system to fit your wants and needs. Check it out all at high family owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com and use the promo code EBC75BB to save $75 off your Warthog purchase. That's at family owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com.
So it actually brings up a question for me, having spent time in Asia. Can you describe really the difference between quote-unquote rice wine and sake? Because a lot of time rice wine was a base for what we might call moonshine here to very interesting kind of drinks. But I would never associate rice wine with sake, having had taste both in different countries.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. You know, when I first started learning about sake, it was described as just, you know, like rice wine. And I think that might come from just the alcohol percentage, you know, being compared to a beer, even though it's brewed and it has a mash. I think that's kind of where it comes from, that rice wine. Is there a rice wine in particular that you're talking about?
No, there would be no rice wine in particular. It'd be the generic. You know, in different countries, you will find it. Vietnam, it was often the rice wine that was made into, it has a snake or a scorpion in the bottle. And so it was often kind of associated with cheap liquor, but highly alcoholic, as you described, as being above 10%, thus preserving whatever animal you were getting in the bottle. But even when you there was a certain amount of, it was also kind of like vodka there. You would do a shot to show manliness when you were doing some other crazy thing with an animal part. And it was always rice wine that they were doing that with.
Well, you said in the presentation that sake literally translates to alcohol.
Yeah, in Japan, and as far as I know, the translation for sake, it means alcohol. And so when you talk about the typical sake that we get here in the United States that's exported out, that's going to be known as Nihonshu. And Nihon in Japanese means Japan. And so shu is the ending, the suffix. And that's going to be, shu is a designation of a type of alcohol. So Nihon shu is the alcohol of Japan.
Now I want to switch gears, unless you have another sake question.
Well, the only other sake question I have is that I believe that this would lend itself very well to fruit infusions and other kinds of infusions. And any tips that you might want to impart? I mean, you know, when I do a fruit infusion, say in a mead, I do that in the secondary. I do a primary fermentation, let the mead pretty much finish out, and then I put it onto fruit. Tell me how I would do that with sake.
You know, I think the world is your oyster as far as that's concerned. But I will say that there have been some craft sake breweries that have tried adding and almost like crafting a different type of sake. And one thing that comes to mind when you bring it up, Steve, is that there have been some sake breweries that are adding hops infusing hops, or maybe some teas or some floral components too. And as far as like when you do that, my initial thoughts would be, yeah, in the secondary, you know, you get some fermentation, and maybe that's like a fusing part towards the end. But you know, with sake, it's a long drawn out fermentation. So maybe adding those in at different times is might have some different benefits, like maybe some biotransformation or some other metabolism from these microbes. Because not only are you dealing with Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the brewer of the sake yeast, but you also have Koji enzymes in play as well. And so I think that that would be really interesting to see how they all fuse and meld together. And I think that, you know, with it being so open now, I think that it's just, like I said, it's another tool belt for the American craft brewer.
I will just say, as we're finishing this up, my sample went from cold as it was served in the keg to medium warm as I was warming it my hands, based off of what you're talking about. There was a period where, I'm just going to say, it was a little bit rougher. And that biscuity became almost like a, like hot burn kind of taste. And then at the last sip, where it's now hand temperature, so around 70 degrees F, it's completely different and much smoother.
Yeah, so the temperature really plays a lot into it. And like I was talking in the fermentation or in the presentation, you know, you really have that trigeminal stimulation that happens when you have chili powder or when you have an alcohol warming sensation, right? And so if you heat up the sake, or maybe this might work for other drinks. I've only done this with sake, but, you know, it really rounds out some of those flavors. For me personally, I like it cold, like around 4 degrees, 5 degrees, 6, maybe under 10 degrees Celsius. And that room temperature area is not my favorite spot to be at, but you know, around 50 degrees Celsius, I think, when it's like, you know, tea temperature, you know, that really rounds out some of those roughness, but balances that trigeminal stimulation that you get.
Sounds like there should be a sampler show.
Hey, there you go.
Where you take three sakis, have them cold, have them warm, and then compare. Because
that'd
when
be
you
great.
When you said about the warm, I realized that the sake I had many years ago was always served warm because that was what you do in Japan, according to my friends who had probably read it in a book somewhere.
Sure.
And so when I warmed it up and it's closer to that temperature, it's very different.
Well, I want to change gears. You guys have an exciting project that I assume that you were instrumental in. It's a new hybrid yeast strain called I-22 Capri. And Steve and I both have brewed things with it. But first of all, tell us about this new project and what all went into it.
Yeah, so we have an Imperial series that we're creating, and it's part of the research and development projects of Imperial Yeast. And you know, it's not just hybrid yeast that we make there, but it's a whole different line of thinking about yeast as a resource for brewers. But specifically talking about our first release here, I-22, it was made during the hybridization process between two different yeast strains, one being a Kvike and one being an English ale strain. And, you know, what we try to do is focus on the sexual cycle of yeast, right? As brewers, when we are fermenting or we are growing yeast, we take it through the budding or the cloning process. So all these yeast cells kind of clone themselves and they get more and more copies. If we change our mindset a little bit, we can manipulate the environment which they're in to have a hybridization process. So they kind of go from replicating during the cloning to going through a sexual cycle, and they make spores, so they're a fungus, much like mushrooms are. So, you know, if you have mushrooms and they're, you know, they pepper little spores down when they're ready to, you know, spread their seed. It's the same process. You know, you put them through, I think we use potassium acetate. I have to go back to my notes exactly. But basically what we do is we limit the amount of nitrogen that they get. So they go through like a hibernation process. And so with less nitrogen and a non-fermentable carbon source, they start to go through a sporulation. And so when yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, when it goes through sporulation, what you end up getting is this sac that contains a tetrad, meaning four spores. And underneath a microscope, what we end up doing is we take these spores, these packets, and we are able to spread them on an auger petri dish. And we'll flip that over, and there's a fiber optic needle that we're able to take and really break up these tetrads and isolate individual spores. And so one of the easiest, or I guess the most, nothing of this is easy, but the most straightforward way to do it is to place spores beside each other. And you have to watch them and you have to test them. But what will happen if you have two spores of different strains, they have to be, number one, they have to be Mat A, and the other one has to be Mat Alpha, which are the two sexes of yeast. And so when the pheromones are correct and everything lines up right and the stars are there and the right music is playing.
I was waiting to see if there are flowers involved.
Yeah, there are.
Chocolate.
What ends up happening is they form this shmoo. And it's a conjugation. I can't make this stuff up. It's a conjugation of the yeast cells. And so they breed, and we go through a process where we kind of thin out the ones that are hybridized, and we go through training with the media that we use, and also with like fermenting process, and we try them out with different breweries. And so some of it's experimental. We're always learning and trying new things. And, and I-22 represents the beginning of that. So
That sounds incredible. So why did you pick these particular two strains? I mean, English ale yeast, which is juice, right? And the Loki, which is a Kvike strain. Why those two?
Well, we tried a bunch, and we are still ongoing trials with stuff. But one thing I can say about the reasoning behind the background of these strains, which an I-22 is really, its fermentation profile is it's a mosaic composition of both the strains. So it's like a melding of them, of their profiles. I will say that Kvike strains are very readily able to mate. So they have a more wild kind of background from their farmhouse Norwegian roots, and so they're used to going through this process, I think, or at least that's what I've found. And so we do that, and then we also try a bunch of different other strains that we know ferment well. And so every once in a while we get lucky, and it is like, if you do lab strains, I'd say about a quarter of the time you have success with brewing. Brewing strains, it's a lot harder, but you do have some success. So anyways, we just try to pick one strain that is a really good mater, so to speak, and another strain that has a good, solid fermentation background.
Great news from our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont. Braggy is back. If you go to Groenfell's YouTube channel, you can see an archived live broadcast with Jess and Ricky the Meadmaker from Groenfell this past week talking about the release of Braggy Batch 3. Braggy is a mead that Ricky says is inspired by the flavors that he tasted while living in Denmark. Wildflower honey, black currants, elder flowers, rose hips, and a touch of juniper berry. It's one of the strong meads of Groenfell and Havoc at 12.5%. And Ricky says they're embracing seasonality at Groenfell and Havoc. Instead of, locking down the character of a mead like this, they're open to a bit of variability, sort of like wine vintages, Anyway, Ricky says Batch 3 of Braggy is delicious. And he teased some news about oak-aged Valkyrie's Choice near the end of the live streaming. So check that out on Groenfell's YouTube channel. And check out all the honey-based deliciousness at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell.
So it's not just pouring a bag of Loki and a bag of juice together.
Kind of mixing them together.
Yeah. I mean,
not that you've tried that, but,
No, but I mean, if you don't have a background in this, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, okay, you pour them together and see what happens. But
because the yeast generally is asexual. It's a budding process, and it's a cloning process. And so you have to essentially, it's stressing them out, right? And making them go into this other form of reproduction.
Yeah, it's definitely a dynamic shift for them because they're yeast are happy most of the time in the right conditions in the environment. So the way that as a scientist and I guess as a brewer, the way that I speak to yeast is that I change the environment to them. And so when I take the potassium acetate, a non-fermentable carbon source, I'm telling it that I want it to do one thing. At least that's what I'm trying to embody. And so it's really about that.
Okay, Zod has already gotten a sample. Should we get samples as well?
I think so.
Oh yeah, that sounds great.
There's a couch. There's an invitingly a couch behind us here.
I'll need that in a few minutes.
So what are we drinking here?
So this is a hazy IPA that was made with I-22 Capri. And we're handing out these little packets here that has the recipe on the back. Yeah.
And who brewed this for you? Cheat sheet.
It's Tannery Run. Tannery Run Brewing.
Okay. And
good.
And so you would think, so okay, Kvik is known for being able to ferment at insanely high temperatures. Since this is a hybrid between with an English yeast, what does that do to the temperature profile?
So currently what we recommend is using at normal ale temperatures. We've done some experiments with temperatures, and, you know, again, since this is like a mosaic fermentation profile of the two, going really high up, we found it does create a little bit of fusel. Not like, you know, this can withstand some slightly elevated, and it ferments quicker, obviously. But I really think the key talking point about I-22, which we found, is that it shines very well when you use active fermentation dry hopping. That's almost like the key to using this.
Oh, interesting. So is that a biotransformation kind of a thing?
You know, we haven't done any analytics on that aspect of it, but we know from sensory that it really lets a lot of these hop aroma compounds shine through. Hmm. Yeah.
Wow. This is a delicious beer.
Yeah, it's very good. And, well, I can't wait to play with this some more.
Yeah, Zod, is the recipe on there? Are you researching the recipe? Tell us about the recipe.
Yeah, they cheated. It's yeah. So it's Amarillo, Galaxy, Nelson Savon, and Cascade. So, yeah, you made a really great hoppy beer with some really great hops. So what makes the Capri part of this Capri versus a really great IPA with USO5 comparatively?
Well, I mean, it has a little bit of both. It's a great beer. It's a great malt profile. It's a great hop profile. But what we found is that active dry hopping with the fermentation, it really, really plays well with synergistically wise. I mean, we've done trials where we've had large batches and small batches, and we've also done trials with different yeast strains. And we really find that the I-22, it's got a little bit of estuary that it gives off. And, you know, anytime we use dry hopping with it, it ferments really well, and it also has a really good flavor and aroma.
So Steve and I both, you know, because we're special, I guess, we got an early release of the pouches. I brewed a no-boil beer with 6 pounds of Breese pale ale malt extract. I brought the wort up to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. I added 2 ounces of Zomba hops at the beginning of a 30-minute hop stand, another 2 ounces of Zomba hops halfway through that, and then I chilled it to 74 degrees Fahrenheit, I believe, and I pitched the Capri. It fermented very well. I put it into a keg like 7-8 days after I brewed it. I let Susan taste the hydrometer sample. She said, pineapple. I get pineapple. I also get a tiny little bit of banana. There's tropical fruit there, and I don't, you know, and of course I don't know how much of that is the hops and how much of that is the yeast, but it was, it's a delicious beer, and I can't wait to taste it when it's all, you know, conditioned and all ready to go. It'll be waiting for me back home.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a great beer, and I expect some samples.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll do some keg fills.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, I-22, it really plays well, like with the hops and with the fermentation profiles. And it does have a really good ester profile. One thing that's really unique about it is is actually the cell size of this is very small.
Huh. I noticed it wasn't very flocculent.
Yeah, it's not super flocculent. It stays in suspension, especially in larger vessels. But, I mean, when we measure it in the lab, it's on the smaller size. And I think that might be due to the hybrid nature of it. But, you know, again, it's all a learning process for us. I mean, we're on the frontier of this, but, you know, there are other yeast strains, like the French Saison, like B64 Napoleon, that actually has a small cell size as well. So we're just really interested in seeing how that plays out with flocculation, repitching, and harvesting. And that's one piece of the puzzle that we have an idea about. But with it being a new strain, we're you know, also writing some of the map out now.
And while I'm thinking about it, we have to emphasize that this isn't a GMO product, right? I mean, you're not doing CRISPR technology to insert genes and things like this. This is a more natural product. I mean, am I correct in that?
Yeah, Steve. Yeah. Sorry, James.
That's right. Sorry. It happens all the time.
I was looking at Steve.
It happens all the time.
But, yeah, this is it's a non-GMO product. It's made naturally, like I was saying. We basically put them through a sporulation process, and then we move them together. The biggest non-natural thing that we have in there would be the Marvin Gaye music. But obviously that's a joke.
No, that's from God.
Okay, let's be clear. Yeah. But we're really trying to explore the natural biodiversity that's present in the yeast strains that we've come to domesticate as brewers ourselves.
Steve, tell us about what you brewed with it.
I did a 3-gallon mead. I just used 6 pounds of raw honey, the pitch, the Capri pitch, a little bit of DAP. It's all I had on hand. I would like to have had some more complicated nutrient, but it's what I had. And put it together, pitched it, room temperature. I didn't heat the water at all, but it was room temperature in Arkansas, so it was slightly warm.
Yeah.
It mixed up well. That's it. I mean, the whole brew day was like an hour. Max, you know, from you know, sanitizing the carboy to putting it in the room where it's fermenting. I did that about 3 days before the conference, and it had just started creating kind of a foam cap, you know, the little brewer's cap, I call it, on top. So I'll see what it looks like when I get home. I'm not sure what to expect from it, but I think it'll make a decent mead. I think it'll make a good mead, actually. And my plan is to take the 3 gallons and to break two out and infuse them with some kind of fruit, though I don't know what yet. Whatever strikes my fancy the day I do it. And leave one of them the way it is, and then we can do a show on it.
Yeah, and there may be some more bottles headed your way.
I'll send some your way.
So is this the first you've heard of anybody playing with mead with the I-22?
It is, yeah. The first time I heard anyone playing with mead with I-22. You know, I'm excited to see, as we're here at the Homebrewers Convention, you know, as you guys have probably seen, there's a wide variety of people who like their specialties. I'm really excited to see what comes of this, and I hope that it produces a mead that sends plentiful bottles my way.
It's only got 3 gallons.
Okay. we'll trade some sake.
There'll be many more, because that's...
So, Steve, it'd be really interesting for me, since this is targeted towards accentuating dry hopping, if you actually dry hopped one of those three things you did.
Yeah, that might happen. Yeah. I'm kind of like, what have I got today?
And you may or may not have some hops left over from when you closed the store, when you sold the store.
Right.
I will send you some dry hops.
I like this conversation more and more.
Well, actually, you can just go over and grab a couple bags of hops here at the conference. You know, put some experimental hops in there so you have no idea what the outcome is when you're done.
Yeah, I think Yakima Chief is right across from us here. This is the next booth over, maybe we can call one of those guys over.
Yeah. So what's next on the... you don't want to give away trade secrets or anything, but I assume that you're playing with other combinations.
Yeah, we are. You know, it's kind of one of those things again that we're always learning and trying new things, and sometimes they don't always work out. So it does take a while to develop new things, and we do have some coming down the pipeline now. I'm pretty excited about it. What else can I say?
How much beer have you had?
Yeah. I think the homebrewers thing comes on around 6. So our finish is there. Come find me.
Yeah, if we really want the scoop, about 9 o'clock tonight.
Sure.
Oh, well, this has been wonderful. I appreciate you spending so much time with us, and I look forward to hearing what's next.
Well, I always love talking to people who are very passionate about brewing and fermentation in general, and so it's been a pleasure for me as well.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Zot. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, James.
I'm just excited I get to try different experiments from Imperial at a conference again. I'm so happy about that.
Amen, brother.
Well, thanks again to Matt, along with Steve and Zot. A lot of fun things coming from Imperial Organic Yeast. Very exciting. And for all the details of making sake at home, jump into the archives at basicbrewingradio.com and go back to November 29th, 2007 with homebrewer Bob Taylor from up in Alaska. Bob gives us an in-depth look at how he was making sake at that time. And he sent me some. Boy, was it good. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. And that's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voice, and we'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.